Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Denial, anger, bargaining, and depression. Sound familiar? It should. This is the history of the Ukraine project in 2025. What is missing, of course, is acceptance. When the West will get there is unclear, but is certainly on the horizon. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Aleksandar Pavic in Belgrade. He is a member of the Serbian Parliament. And here in Moscow, we cross to Dmitry Babic. He is the deputy foreign editor at Komsomolskaya Pravda Daily. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Aleksandar in Belgrade. Well, as you both noticed, and the audience as well, is that I use the stages of denial and grief. And the reason why I chose that is in looking at the Ukraine project, as I call it, the West Ukraine project for this year that's about to end, you notice I didn't use political or economic terms. I used psychological terms because this is really what it's gotten down to. The West is in denial about reality, and the more you're in denial about reality, the longer the conflict will continue and the more damage that'll be done, particularly to the Europeans themselves, not to speak of the Ukrainians. So I thought I would start out this way because we really need the assistance of psychologists right now because they're not dealing with grounded reality. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I would agree with you. I think the first thing that comes to my mind is primal scream therapy. You know, I think we all feel like it a little bit, especially in Europe. And I agree with you for using this methodology and terminology, because if you look at all this politically, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. It's totally irrational. However, if you look at these EU elites, especially as people are more and more removed from reality, then it makes sense. I think you termed it the last time we talked fantasy thinking. You know, they're projecting their fantasies and their wishes onto reality and hoping, you know, against hope that it'll turn out that way. And this is not reality. That's not what politics is about. And the thing is, it's obvious now, if it wasn't obvious before, they never had a plan B. They were convinced that it was going to work, that the sanctions from hell were going to bring the Russian economy to its knees, that the terrible Vladimir Putin was going to fall, you know, there were going to be a big democratic uprising in Russia, and all their problems would be solved. And it's not happening. But they're not abandoning that fantasy. They're clinging to it because obviously they put all their money onto that. They bet all their money onto that, and it was a bad bet, and they don't know how to get out of it. And they know there will be huge repercussions, responsibility, if they admit defeat. So they're plowing ahead, you know, and at the expense of, what, 1.5 million lives so far in Ukraine at least. And now they want to bring in European boys to fight their battles, to prevent them from reaping what they sowed. So, you know, that's the problem we have in Europe right now. And it's much more than political.
You know, Dima, I agree completely with Aleksandar. They want to postpone the reckoning. Okay, this is what they're worried about because, you know, as a former historian myself, when I look at all of the major political figures that were involved with the Treaty of Versailles ending the First World War in the West, every person that was deeply involved in that process was politically destroyed afterwards. And I think that I don't think any of the cast of characters that we're dealing with, Merz, Stalmer, Macron, they're not of that intellectual capacity to understand what I'm talking about. But historically, if you tied yourself to the Ukraine project, your legacy is going to be one of failure and of irresponsibility. Dima?
You're absolutely right. If we look at the First World War, all the persons involved, Poincaré, Atkins, you know, on both sides, not to speak about the Kaiser.
The reason why I asked you that, because I knew you would understand it, okay? But if Aleksandar, yourself, and I would say this to Macron, he wouldn't have a clue what we're talking about. Keep going, Dima.
Well, this is the problem. The Europeans have sabotaged three times peace plans just this year. The one after Anchorage, you know, they met Trump and they tried to make all of his plans devoid of meaning, all of his possible deals with Putin. The second time, before the summit in Budapest, which never took place, primarily, I think, because of the efforts of Europeans. Now they're doing the same with Trump's peace plan of 28 points, saying at the same time that they want Russia to accept Trump's peace plan, you know, but in their interpretation. And if we take a broader look at what's going on, I think the whole conflict between Russia and Ukraine was a part and is a part of a larger process, which I would call demonization of Russia. The modern European political religion, if you want, you know, is based on a simplified interpretation of World War II. They see World War II as just one big anti-Semitic operation, which was produced by one demonic individual who had been, unfortunately, appeased by the global powers before the start of the war in 1939. And of course, like any simplified version, it contains some grains of truth. Hitler was an anti-Semite. Holocaust did take place. Hitler had been appeased prior to 1939. But many other points are not taken into account. They're simply taken out of the picture. And of course, Russia is basically insulted by this interpretation, because the Europeans, they uncritically apply the same pattern to Russia's behavior. We are supposed to be the Third Reich. You know, our president is supposed to be a new Hitler who was stopped at the stage, you know, of 1938. And the problem with this version, it's not just that it is simply wrong, it's simply a lie. The problem is that it doesn't leave any room for negotiations. You don't appease dictators. You don't negotiate with the Satan. But the problem is, if you keep calling, even Archangel Gabriel, if you keep calling him the Satan, very soon he will start to behave like Archangel Michael, which means more defensively, and probably much worse in the future. So basically, if you ask me, how can we guarantee peace in Europe? It's not just security guarantees for Russia, for Ukraine. The only way forward is for these people in Europe to abandon this vision of history, this demonization of Russia, and basically demonization of any other opponent that the EU has. For the EU, everyone who objects to them is Hitler. Milosevic was Hitler, you know. We are all the Third Reich. Saddam Hussein was Hitler. Everyone is Hitler. So until they continue with this narrative, they're going to be a threat to the world and to themselves.
To themselves. To themselves. Exactly. Excellent. Alexander, you know, since Dima brought up history, which, you know, we're very good friends. We've been friends for over 25 years. We talk history all of the time. But there is a historical parallel. The Soviet Union, then Russia today, has security interests. And Europe does not recognize that. And that is why the security architecture that was developed after the Second World War and amended after the Cold War is without Russia and against Russia. This is why we have this conflict, okay? So geopolitical interests do not change. Political systems may change and personalities may change, but security interests don't. Alexander.
Well, let's go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, did the United States have a legitimate security interest to not have nuclear warheads, nuclear rockets near its shore, 90 miles from its shores? Yes. Okay. Why doesn't Russia have the same interest of not having NATO's nuclear armed rockets on Ukrainian territory, five minutes flight time from Moscow? That's legitimate. In a nuclear era, you must have these considerations in mind. You can't ignore them before the nuclear era, okay, but not anymore. So, you know, this concept that the Russians have been talking about for years about indivisible security, you know, the West is looking down on it with disdain. But it's actually in the nuclear era, it's the only way to look at security. You know, no one's is secure if a great power who is nuclearly armed is insecure.
But Alexander, I'm glad you bring that up because the West, if we look at the Helsinki process in the 1970s, that's where we got the term indivisibility of security. What I would argue, I'll throw this to Dima right now, is that these ideas about security have gone to the wayside because this European elite is so ideologically possessed. It blinds them to common sense even. Dima.
Okay. Well, Jeffrey Sachs put it very rightly recently when he wrote that Europe historically ignored Russia's security interests. When Europe built alliances against Russia, against Serbia, other countries, that was legitimate defense in the minds of these people. When Russia tried to secure its own interests, that was viewed as paranoia, 19th century thinking, something that we need to get rid of. And coming back to the historical narrative, because they're very important here, besides this simplified narrative of the World War II as a big anti-Semitic operation, we have the view of the Global South. For the Global South, the World War II was basically a colonial war. And that is also supported by the facts. Hitler called Russia Germany's India. He wanted to use the same methods in Russia which the British used in India. And that is now very understandable to Indians, you know. They view the World War II through this prism, you know. The huge inhuman acts which Hitler committed in Europe were in fact very similar to what the European powers did in their colonies. The whole scandal was that it happened in Europe, in the middle of their civilization. If we look at the big picture, what was World War II? It was an attempt by an aggressive ideology to spread its influence to all the world. And that makes the modern global West, I'm sorry, it leads to some very unpleasant comparisons and unpleasant parallels. Russia and China, both countries, they don't want to spread their narratives to the whole world. They speak for diversity. You know, in BRICS, we have monarchies, we have communist regimes, we have whatever.
I have to interrupt you, Dima. What they all have in common is they believe in sovereignty and security. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Another thing that we have experienced, Alexander, this year, Dima has already mentioned it, three major attempts to somehow come to a brokered peace. Problem is that the United States is a belligerent in this and cannot operate as a mediator. And we've seen this, the tension of trying to do both, be both at the same time. But, you know, all of the squabbling and all of the white noise coming from the Europeans, amending, just the very idea of amending Trump's peace plan. I mean, Dima's right. They just want to put their fingerprints all over it and change its meaning completely. But really, if you look at the way the Russians have approached this, and they've been very transparent, they haven't changed their aims at all during this conflict. They're more interested, if you think about it, they're more interested in what the security situation is going to be that it would include Russia and Ukraine and Russia and NATO. And if you look at their so-called war aims, it's all about security after hostilities have ended. The problem is the Europeans are just simply incapable of looking at that because they already have an end game that they want to see, and there's no way they're going to get it. That's why we have one proposal after another, you know, 28 points, 20 points, 14 points. They're chasing their tail. The Russians are waiting for them to come to their senses. I don't know if they will, but this conflict will come to an end, and it will come to an end not at the peace table, but on the battlefield. Alexander.
Well, yeah, sensible people can come to their senses. We're not dealing with sensible people. That's one thing. The second thing is Russia constantly talks about, this is a key term, root causes. Let's get at the root causes of the conflict. And the root cause of the conflict is NATO's expansion after the disbandment of the Warsaw Pact. Why did NATO continue to exist? And they were warned. They were warned numerous times, not just from Russia, but from old experienced Cold War hands from the West itself. And, you know, to no avail. They kept expanding. And the last attempt, we must always remember, Russia made one last attempt in December of 2021. They offered proposals both to the U.S. and NATO. And one thing that was in that proposal was practically going back to 1997, to the state of affairs 1997, to remove this military advancement towards the east, which was a result of NATO expansion. It was a hazard for Russia's security interests. Nobody listened. And as Vladimir Putin said in 2018, when he introduced the new weapons, including the Avangard and the Burevestnik, etc., he said, now they will listen. But they didn't listen even then. And so now they're faced with a strategic defeat in Ukraine. They still don't want to listen. But I must say, I must give an amendment to our earlier exchange. There is a method to the madness. And just recently, a couple of days ago, Russian Senator Konstantin Kosachev, he's the deputy head of the Federation Council, he's a senator. He gave an interview to RIA Novosti, and it was quite a good interview. You know, he said, he pointed out one thing, which is certainly true. The deep state in the U.S. and the EU elites are also trying to buy time, hoping that the midterm elections will go the other way, that the Democrats will win, that Trump's hands will be tied. And then, you know, hopefully 2 years later, they'll have a Democrat back in the White House. And, you know, good old days again, escalation talk, you know, war, and, you know, things will be back to normal again. So that's
Alexander, really dangerous calculus. I've come across this quite a bit, actually. But with that calculus, political calculus, how does Ukraine fare over this time? Okay. I mean, again, this really tells us everything about this conflict. It is ideologically driven by the West. They believe that they are morally superior, that they are the fulfillment of the human condition. And they really think very highly of themselves, actually. Okay. But how does this help their friend Zelensky and the Ukrainian people? It doesn't.
No, it doesn't. But they don't care about that.
That's right.
I mean, they don't care. Zelensky is just a tool. And he's been a useful tool in their proxy war against Russia. They would have found another Zelensky. They don't care about the Ukrainian people at all. They just don't. We had a stunning recent revelation. What was her name? Amanda Sloat, I think.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, she said, well, you know, we could have agreed to the Istanbul Agreement in 2022 and it would have prevented war. But, you know, I felt kind of uncomfortable granting Russia a sphere of influence. So it was better to have 1.5 million people killed, you know. That's the psychological portrait of these people.
Worried about granting Russia a sphere of influence. Well, what is NATO? It's America's sphere of influence. These people are so blinded, they don't apply any common sense. Okay, sovereign states, if you have the power, will demand security. If you're weak, you're not going to have sovereignty. And weak countries have to live with that. But if you're a strong country and you can push back, They will push back. It doesn't have anything to do with Russia, China, India, Brazil. It's about the nature of geopolitics. If you have power, resources, and a strategy, you may succeed. Dima.
Well, I agree with you in principle, because even if we look at the way Europeans sabotaged Trump's basically three attempts to have peace in Ukraine, basically the Europeans and Zelensky returned to the same unholy trinity. You know, no territorial concessions, immediate ceasefire, and so-called security guarantees for Ukraine.
Yeah, but David, logic would dictate you would have to be winning the conflict to make those demands.
Exactly.
But they're losing that. So how can they make these demands if they're losing? It doesn't make any sense.
It makes sense in terms of ideology. You know, it doesn't make sense in any terms of real politics and balance of forces. I mean, look at the figures. Ukraine still holds 11% of the territory of Donbas. That is a demand of Russia to hand Donbas with its mostly Russian-speaking population to Russia. So Russia is gaining about 178 kilometers every week, right? Every day. So in 100 days, maybe a little more, we will get all of Donbas because only 11% remains. What's the attitude of Europe? Not to notice that, you know, these people, you should understand their logic. This is the logic of an ideological state. You may waste resources, you may waste people, but you don't go against the principles of that ideology. And in that sense, you know, when we talked about impunity, about responsibility for what happened, did anyone in the United States or in the European Union take responsibility for the Iraqi disaster? Is Tony Blair in jail? Was Dick Cheney indicted? No. So these people hope to get away with impunity this time too, but they will lose their jobs immediately if they go against this ideology, if they say something like Putin has a point or whatever. And money is not a problem here. I mean, let me give you some statistics. Trump keeps talking about Joe Biden giving $350 billion to the Ukrainian regime. In the first 2 years of the conflict. I don't know, he may be exaggerating, yeah. But I can tell you all the money that democratic Ukraine received from the West before it became undemocratic in 2014, between 1991 and 2014, Ukraine got from the West only about $34 billion in loans with huge interest for the West. And now these people are giving Ukraine another loan, 90 billion euros, just, you know, like that. They know they will not get it back. You know, they know Russia will not pay these so-called reparations. Money is not a problem for these people. Ideology is much more.
Well, eventually it will, because Alexander is the 90 billion euros that Dima is mentioning, and that's just mugging of the European taxpayer. It's a sweetheart loan to the Kiev regime that will never be paid back, and the European taxpayer picks up the tab. The problem is that, again, if you're winning, then maybe there's a logic behind it, but you're losing. So what happens when the 90 billion euros are stolen? So you pony up 90 billion more? It defies logic.
Well, again, they didn't have plan B. They don't want to accept even the possibility of losing, of admitting that Russia won, that their Ukraine proxy war has been a failure. They don't want to face the music. So, you know, and this 90 billion was approved only after the scheme of stealing Russian funds failed, as thanks mostly to, in the first place, to Viktor Orban. I think also Robert Fico had a hand in it. But, you know, they haven't
given up. And give credit where credit's due. The Belgians didn't want to be held responsible.
That's fair. Yes, absolutely. But again, you know, I make a difference between Orban and the Belgians, because Belgians only wanted to save their own hide. They would have done it if they would have avoided responsibility. Orban is genuinely against the war, you know, so I give him more credit.
We're almost out of time here. I know France and Germany actually have some Russian sovereign assets, but they haven't confiscated them the way they wanted the Belgians to do. Again, the level of hypocrisy to these people that, you know, they, no one wants to be held responsible. No one wants to. Well, if they can have elections, and that's a pretty dodgy proposition in Europe these days, a la the Romanian caper, their populations, their citizens will lash out at them for this gross irresponsibility of Europe's security and its economy. On that very dismal point, we're at the end of the program. I want to thank my guests in Belgrade and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.